that can detect a virus. The best way to find a virus in the wild at the present time is to place a sentinel animal at the suspected location of the virus and hope the animal gets sick. Johnson figured that if any of his monkeys or guinea pigs crashed, he would be able to isolate the virus from the sick animals and would perhaps be able to discover how the animals had caught it. 1988, spring. The Katoom Cave expedition set up headquarters in the Mount Elgon Lodge, a decayed resort dating from the 1920s, when the English had ruled East Africa. The lodge had been built for sporting people and trout fishermen. It sat on a promontory overlooking the red dirt road that wound up the mountain to Katoom Cave. It had once been surrounded by English gardens, which had partly collapsed into clay and African weeds. Indoors, there were hardwood floors, waxed daily to a perfect gleam. The lodge had turrets with round rooms and medieval doors, hand-carved from African olive wood, and the living room boasted an immense fireplace with a carved mantelpiece. The staff spoke very little English, but they were intent on maintaining English hospitality for the rare guest who might happen to show up. The Mount Elgon Lodge was a monument to the incomplete failure of the British Empire, which carried on automatically like an uncontrollable tick in the provincial backwaters of Africa long after it had died at the core. In the evenings, as the frost-tinged night came on, the staff built fires of Elgon olive logs in the fireplaces, and the food in the dining room was horrible in the best English tradition. There was, however, a splendid bar. It was a quaint hideaway in a round chamber, stocked with shining rows of Tusker beer bottles and French aperitifs and obscure African brandies. The men could sit at the bar and drink Tuskers, or lean on the great mantel by the fire and tell stories after a hard day in the cave wearing a spacesuit. A sign on the wall by the concierge's desk mentioned the delicate matter of money. It announced that since the Mount Elgon Lodge's suppliers had cut off all credit to the lodge was, unfortunately, unable to extend any credit to its guests. They moved the animals up the mountain in stages to let them get used to the climate. When they got to the valley that leads to the cave, they cleared away some underbrush and put up blue tarpaulins. The cave itself was considered to be a level 4 hot zone. The tarp closest to the cave covered a gray area, a place where the worlds met. The men took chemical showers under the gray area tarp to decon their spacesuits after a visit to the cave. Another tarp covered a level 3 staging area where the men changed in and out of their spacesuits. Another tarp covered a level 4 necropsy area. Under that tarp, wearing spacesuits, they dissected any small animals they had trapped, looking for signs of Marburg virus. "We were going where no one had gone before," Johnson said to me. "We brought the biosafety level 4 philosophy to the jungle." They wore orange Raycal spacesuits inside the cave. A Raycal suit is a portable, positive-pressure spacesuit with a battery-powered air supply. It's for use in fieldwork with extreme biohazards that are believed to be airborne. A Raycal suit is also known as an orange suit because it's bright orange. It's lighter than a Kamchurian, and unlike a Kamchurian, it's fully portable with a self-contained breathing apparatus. The main body of the suit, apart from the helmet and the blowers, is disposable, so that you can burn it after using it once or twice. Wearing their Raycal spacesuits, they laid out a trail that wound into Katoom Cave, marking the trail with avalanche poles so that people wouldn't get lost. Along the trail, they placed cages holding the monkeys and guinea pigs. They surrounded the cages with electrified wire, powered by a battery, to discourage leopards from trying to eat the monkeys. They placed some of the monkeys directly underneath bat colonies in the roof of the cave, hoping that something would drop on a monkey that would cause the animal to break with Marburg. They collected somewhere between 30,000 and 70,000 biting insects inside the cave. The cave is full of bugs. "We put stickum paper over cracks in the cave to catch crawling bugs," Johnson said to me. "We hung light traps inside the cave to collect flying insects. The light traps were battery-powered. You know how to collect ticks? They come out of the ground when they smell carbon dioxide from your breath. They smell it and come up and bite your ass. So we brought these huge tanks of carbon dioxide, and we used it to attract ticks. We trapped all the rodents that went into the cave. We used Havahart traps. Way at the back of the cave, by a pool of water, we found sandflies. These are biting flies. We saw leopard tracks all over the place, and Cape Buffalo tracks. We didn't take any blood samples from large animals, nothing from leopards or buffalo, nothing from the antelopes. Could Marburg live in large African cats? I asked. Could it be a leopard virus? Maybe. We just didn't have permits to trap leopards. We did collect genet cats, and it wasn't there. Could it live in elephants? Did you ever try to draw blood from a wild elephant? We didn't. The Kenyan naturalists trapped and netted hundreds of birds, rodents, hyraces, and bats. In the hot necropsy zone, under the tarp, they sacrificed the animals and dissected them, while wearing Raykal suits, taking samples of blood and tissue, which they froze in jars of liquid nitrogen. Some local people, they were Elgon Maasai, had lived inside some of the caves on Mount Elgon and had kept their cattle in the caves. The Kenyan doctors drew blood from these people and took their medical histories, and drew blood from their cattle. None of the local people or the cattle tested positive for Marburg antibodies. If they had tested positive, it would have shown that they had been exposed to Marburg. Despite the fact that nobody showed signs of having been infected, the Elgon Maasai could tell stories of how a family member, a child or a young wife, had died bleeding in someone's arms. They had seen family members crash and bleed out, but whether their illnesses were caused by Marburg or some other virus, who could tell? Perhaps the local Maasai people knew the Marburg agent in their own way. If so, they'd never given it a name. None of the sentinel monkeys became sick. They remained healthy and bored, having sat in their cages in the cave for weeks. The experiment required that they be sacrificed at the end of the time, so that the researchers could take tissue samples and observe their bodies for any signs of infection. At this point, the hard part of primate research began to torment Gene Johnson. He couldn't bring himself to euthanize the monkeys. He couldn't stand the idea of killing them and couldn't go into the cave to finish the job. He waited outside in the forest while another member of the team put on a spacesuit and went inside and gave the monkeys massive shots of sedative, which put them to sleep forever. "I don't like killing animals," he said to me. "That was a major issue for me. After you've fed and watered monkeys for 30 days, they become your friends. I fed them bananas. That was terrible. It sucked." He put on his orange Raykal spacesuit and opened up the monkeys under the necropsy tent, feeling frustrated and sad, especially when all the monkeys turned out to be healthy. The expedition was a dry hole. All of the sentinel animals remained healthy, and the blood and tissue samples from the other animals, insects, birds, Maasai people, and their cattle showed no signs of Marburg virus. It must have been a bitter disappointment for Gene Johnson, so disheartening that he was never able to bring himself to publish an account of the expedition and its findings. There seemed to be no point in publishing the fact that he hadn't found anything in Katoom Cave. All that he could say for sure is that Marburg lives in the shadow of Mount Elgon. What Johnson didn't know at the time, but what he sensed almost instinctively after the failure of the Katoom Cave expedition, was that the knowledge and experience he gained inside a cave in Africa, and the spacesuits and biohazard gear he carried back with him to the Institute, might serve him well at another time and in another place. He kept his African gear hidden away at the Institute, piled in olive-drab military trunks in storage rooms and in tractor trailers parked behind buildings and padlocked, because he didn't want anyone else to touch his gear or use it or take it away from him. He wanted to be ready to load it on an airplane at a moment's notice in case Marburg or Ebola came to the surface again in Africa. And sometimes he thought of a favorite saying, a remark by Louis Pasteur, "Chance favors the prepared mind." Pasteur developed vaccines for anthrax and rabies. 1989, summer. The Army had always had a hard time figuring out what to do with Nancy and Jerry Jacks. They were married officers at the same rank in a small corps, the veterinary corps. What do you do with a married pair of doggy doctors who need to be promoted? What if one of them, the wife, is trained in the use of spacesuits? Where do you send them? The Army assigned the Jackses to the Institute of Chemical Defense near Aberdeen, Maryland. They sold their Victorian house and moved, bringing their birds and animals with them. Nancy wasn't sorry to leave the house in Thurmont. They moved into a tract house, which was more to her liking, and there they began to raise fish in tanks as a hobby, and Nancy went to work in an army program to study the effects of nerve gas on rat brains. Her job was to open up the rat's head and figure out what the nerve gas had done to the brain. This was safer and more pleasant than working with Ebola, but it was a little dull. Eventually, she and Jerry both received promotions to lieutenant colonel and wore silver oak leaves on their shoulders. Jamie and Jason were growing up. Jamie became a superb gymnast, short and wiry like Nancy, and Nancy and Jerry had hopes for her in the Nationals, if not the Olympics. Jason grew into a tall, quiet kid. Herky, the parrot, didn't change. Parrots live for many years. He went on shouting, "Mom! Mom!" and whistling the march from the Bridge on the River Kwai. Colonel Tony Johnson, Nancy's commanding officer when she had worked at USAMRID, remembered her competence in a spacesuit and wanted to get her back. He felt she belonged at the Institute. He was eventually appointed head of pathology at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and when that happened, his old job came open, the job of chief of pathology at the Institute. He urged the Army to appoint Nancy Jacks to the position, and the Army listened. They agreed that she ought to be doing hot biological work, and she got the job in the summer of 1989. At the same time, the Army appointed Jerry Jacks head of the veterinary division at the Institute. So the Jackses became important and rather powerful figures. Nancy went back to biological work in spacesuits. Jerry still didn't like it, but he learned to live with it. With these promotions, the Jackses sold their house in Aberdeen and moved back to Thurmont in August 1989. This time, Nancy told Jerry it was not going to be a Victorian. They bought a contemporary Cape house with dormer windows, with a lot of land around it, meadow and forest, where the dogs could run and the children could play. Their house stood on the lower slope of Catoctin Mountain, overlooking the town, above a sea of apple orchards. From their kitchen window, they could look into the distance over rolling farmland where armies had marched during the Civil War. Central Maryland stretched away to the horizon in folds and hollows, in bands of trees and rumpled fields, studded by silos that marked the presence of family farms. High over the beautiful countryside, passenger jets crisscrossed the sky, leaving white contrails behind them. Part 2. The Monkey House. Reston, 1989, October 4th, Wednesday. The city of Reston, Virginia, is a prosperous community about 10 miles west of Washington, D.C., just beyond the Beltway. On a fall day, when a western wind clears the air, from the upper floors of the office buildings in Reston, you can see the creamy spike of the Washington Monument, sitting in the middle of the mall, and beyond it, the Capitol Dome. The population of Reston has grown in recent years, and high-technology businesses and blue-chip consulting firms have moved into office parks there, where glass buildings grew up during the 1980s like crystals. Before the crystals appeared, Reston was surrounded by farmland, and it still contains meadows. In spring, the meadows burst into galaxies of yellow mustard flowers, and robins and thrashers sing in stands of tulip trees and white ash. The town offers handsome residential neighborhoods, good schools, parks, golf courses, excellent daycare for children. There are lakes in Reston named for American naturalists. Lake Thoreau, Lake Audubon, surrounded by expensive waterfront homes. Reston is situated within easy commuting distance of downtown Washington. Along Leesburg Pike, which funnels traffic into the city, there are developments of executive homes with Mercedes-Benzes parked in crescent-shaped driveways. Reston was once a country town, and its history still fights obliteration, like a nail that won't stay hammered down. Among the upscale houses, you see the occasional bungalow with cardboard stuffed in a broken window, and a pickup truck parked in the side yard. In the autumn, vegetable stands along Leesburg Pike sell pumpkins and butternut squash. Not far from Leesburg Pike, there's a small office park. It was built in the 1960s, and isn't as glassy or as fashionable as the newer office parks, but it's clean and neat, and it's been there long enough for sycamores and sweet gum trees to grow up around it and throw shade over the lawns. Across the street, a McDonald's is jammed at lunch hour with office workers. In the autumn of 1989, a company called Hazelton Research Products was using a one-story building in the office park as a monkey house. Hazelton Research Products is a division of Corning Incorporated. Corning's Hazelton unit is involved with the importation and sale of laboratory animals. The Hazelton Monkey House was known as the Reston Primate Quarantine Unit. Each year, about 16,000 wild monkeys are imported into the United States from the tropical regions of the Earth. Imported monkeys must be held in quarantine for a month before they are shipped anywhere else in the United States. This is to prevent the spread of infectious diseases that could kill other primates, including humans. Dan Dalgard, a doctor of veterinary medicine, was the consulting veterinarian at the Reston Primate Quarantine Unit. He was on call to take care of the monkeys if they became sick or needed medical attention. He was actually a principal scientist at another company owned by Corning, called Hazelton Washington. This company has its headquarters on Leesburg Pike, not far from the monkey house, and so Dalgard could easily drive his car over to Reston to check on the monkeys if he was needed there. Dalgard was a tall man in his 50s, with metal-framed glasses, pale blue eyes, and a soft drawl that he had picked up in Texas at veterinary school. Generally, he wore a gray business suit if he was working in his office, or a white lab coat if he was working with animals. He had an international reputation as a knowledgeable and skilled veterinarian who specialized in primate husbandry. He was a calm, even-tempered man. On evenings and weekends, he repaired antique clocks as a hobby. He liked to fix things with his hands. It made him feel peaceful and calm, and he was patient with a jammed clock. He sometimes had longings to leave veterinary medicine and devote himself full-time to clocks. On Wednesday, October 4th, 1989, Hazelton Research Products accepted a shipment of 100 wild monkeys from the Philippines. The shipment originated at Fairlight Farms, a monkey wholesale facility located not far from Manila. The monkeys themselves came from coastal rainforests on the island of Mindanao. The monkeys had been shipped by boat to Fairlight Farms, where they were grouped together in large cages known as gang cages. The monkeys were then put into wooden crates and flown to Amsterdam on a specially fitted cargo airplane, and from Amsterdam they were flown to New York City. They arrived at JFK International Airport and were driven by truck down the eastern seaboard of the United States to the Reston Monkey House. The monkeys were crab-eating monkeys, a species that lives along rivers and in mangrove swamps in Southeast Asia. Crab-eaters are used as laboratory animals because they are common, cheap, and easily obtained. They have long, arching, whip-like tails, whitish fur on the chest, and cream-colored fur on the back. The crab-eater is a type of macaque. It's sometimes called a long-tailed macaque. The monkey has a protrusive, dog-like snout with flaring nostrils and sharp canine teeth. The skin is pinkish-gray, close to the color of a white person. The hand looks quite human, with a thumb and delicate fingers with fingernails. The females have two breasts on the upper chest that look startlingly human, with pale nipples. Crab-eaters do not like humans. They have a competitive relationship with people who live in the rainforest. They like vegetables, especially eggplants, and they like to raid farmers' crops. Crab-eating monkeys travel in a troop, making tumbling jumps through the trees, screaming, "Craw! Craw!" They know perfectly well that after they have pulled off an eggplant raid, they are likely to have a visit from a farmer who will come around looking for them with a shotgun. And so they have to be ready to move out and head deep into the forest at a moment's notice. The sight of a gun will set off their alarm cries, "Craw! Craw! Craw!" In some parts of the world, these monkeys are called craws because of the sound they make, and many people who live in Asian rainforests consider them to be obnoxious pests. At the close of day, when night comes, the troop goes to sleep in a dead, leafless tree. This is the troop's home tree. The monkeys prefer to sleep in a dead tree so that they can see in all directions, keeping watch for humans and other predators. The monkey tree usually hangs out over a river so that they can relieve themselves from the branches without littering the ground. At sunrise, the monkeys stir and wake up, and you hear their cries as they greet the sun. The mothers gather their children and herd them along the branches, and the troop moves out, leaping through trees, searching for fruit. They like to eat all kinds of things. In addition to vegetables and fruits, they eat insects, grass, roots, and small pieces of clay, which they chew and swallow, perhaps to get salt and minerals. They lust after crabs. When the urge for crabs comes upon them, the troop will head for a mangrove swamp to have a feeding bout. They descend from the trees and take up positions in the water beside crab holes. A crab comes out of its hole, and the monkey snatches it out of the water. The monkey has a way to deal with the crab's claws. He grabs the crab from behind as it emerges from its hole and rips off the claws and throws them away, and then devours the rest of the crab. Sometimes a monkey isn't quick enough with the claws, and the crab latches onto the monkey's fingers, and the monkey lets out a shriek and shakes its hand, trying to get the crab off, and jumps around in the water. You can always tell when crab eaters are having a feeding bout on crabs, because you hear an occasional string of shrieks coming out of the swamp as a result of difficulty with a crab. The troop has a strict hierarchy. It's led by a dominant male, the largest, most aggressive monkey. He maintains control over the troop by staring. He stares down subordinates if they challenge him. If a human stares at a dominant male monkey in a cage, the monkey will rush to the front of the cage, staring back, and will become exceedingly angry, slamming against the bars, trying to attack the person. He will want to kill the human who stared at him. He can't afford to show fear when his authority is challenged by another primate. If two dominant male monkeys are placed in the same cage, only one monkey will leave the cage alive. The crab-eating monkeys at the Reston Monkey House were placed each in its own cage under artificial lights and were fed monkey biscuits and fruit. There were 12 monkey rooms in the monkey house, and they were designated by the letters A through L. Two of the monkeys that arrived on October 4th were dead in their crates. That was not unusual, since monkeys die during shipments. But in the next 3 weeks, an unusual number of monkeys began to die at the Reston Monkey House. On October 4th, the same day the shipment of monkeys reached the Reston Monkey House, something happened that would change Jerry Jax's life forever. Jerry had a brother named John, who lived in Kansas City with his wife and two small children. John Jax was a prominent businessman and a banker, and he was a partner in a manufacturing company that made plastic for credit cards. He was a couple of years younger than Jerry, and the two men were as close as brothers can be. They'd grown up together on a farm in Kansas and had both gone to college at Kansas State. They looked very much alike, tall with prematurely gray hair, a beak nose, sharp eyes, a calm manner, and their voices sounded alike. The only difference in appearance between them was that John wore a mustache and Jerry did not. John Jax and his wife planned to attend a parent-teacher's meeting on the evening of October 4th at their children's school. Near the end of the day, John telephoned his wife from his office at the manufacturing plant to tell her that he would be working late. She happened to be out of the house when he called, so he left a message on the answering machine explaining that he would go directly from the office to the meeting, and he would see her there. When he didn't show up, she became worried. She drove over to the factory. The place was deserted, the machines silent. She walked the length of the factory floor to a staircase. John's office overlooked the factory floor from a balcony at the top of the staircase. She climbed the stairs. The door to his office was standing open a crack, and she went inside. John had been shot many times, and there was blood all over the room. It was a violent killing. The police officer who took the case at Kansas City Homicide was named Reed Buente. He had known John personally and had admired him, having worked for him as a security guard at the Bank of Kansas City when John was president of the bank. Officer Buente was determined to solve the case and bring the killer or killers to trial. But as time went by and no breaks came along, the investigator became discouraged. John Jax had been having difficulties with his partner in the plastic business, a man named John Weaver, and Kansas City Homicide looked at the partner as a suspect. When I called Officer Buente recently, he confirmed this. Weaver has since died of a heart attack, and the case remains open, since unsolved murder cases are never closed. There were few physical clues, and Weaver, as it turned out, had an alibi. The investigator ran into more and more difficulties with the case. At one point, he said to Jerry, "You can have someone killed pretty easy, and it's cheap. You can have someone killed for what you would pay for a desk." The murder of John Jax threw Jerry into a paralysis of grief. Time is supposed to heal all things, but time opened an emotional gangrene in Jerry. Nancy began to think that he was in a clinical depression. I feel like my life is over, he said to her. It's just not the same anymore. My life will never be the same. It's just inconceivable that Johnny could have had an enemy. At the funeral in Kansas City, Nancy and Jerry's children, Jamie and Jason, looked into the coffin and said to their father, Gee, Dad, he looks like you lying there. He called Kansas City Homicide nearly every day during October and November. The investigator just couldn't break the case. Jerry began to think about getting a gun and going out to Kansas City to kill John's business partner. He thought, if I do it, I'll be in jail. And what about my children? And what if John's partner hadn't been behind the murder? Then I'll have killed an innocent man. November the 1st, Wednesday. The colony manager at the Reston Monkey House will be called Bill Volt. As he watched his monkeys die, Volt became concerned. On November 1st, a little less than a month after the shipment of monkeys had arrived, he put in a telephone call to Dan Dalgard, telling him that the monkeys that had recently arrived from the Philippines were dying in unusually large numbers. He had counted 29 deaths out of a shipment of 100 monkeys. That is, nearly a third of the monkeys had died. At the same time, a problem had developed with the building's heating and air handling system. The thermostat had failed, and the heat would not go off. The heaters dumped heat at full blast into the building, and the air conditioning system wouldn't kick in. It had become awfully hot inside the building. Volt wondered if the heat might be putting stress on the monkeys. He had noticed that most of the deaths had taken place in one room, room F, which was located on a long hallway at the back of the building. Dalgard agreed to drive over to the monkey house and have a look, but he became busy with other things and didn't get there until the following week. When he arrived, Bill Volt took him to room F, the focus of the deaths, so that Dalgard could inspect the monkeys. They put on white coats and surgical masks, and the two men walked down a long cinder block corridor lined on both sides with steel doors leading to monkey rooms. The corridor was very warm, and they began to sweat. Through windows in the doors, they could see hundreds of monkey eyes looking at them as they passed. The monkeys were exquisitely sensitive to the presence of humans. Room F contained only crab-eating monkeys from the October shipment from Fairlight Farms in the Philippines. Each monkey sat in its own cage. The monkeys were subdued. A few weeks ago, they had been swinging in the trees, and they didn't like what had happened to them. Dalgard went from cage to cage, glancing at the animals. He could tell a lot about a monkey from the look in its eyes. He could also read its body language. He searched for animals that seemed passive or in pain. Dalgard's staring into their eyes drove them berserk. When he passed a dominant male and looked carefully at it, it rushed him, wanting to take him out. He found a monkey whose eyes had a dull appearance, not shiny and bright, but glazed and somewhat inactive. The eyelids were down, slightly squinted. Normally, the lids would be retracted so that you could see the entire iris. A healthy monkey's eyes would be like two bright circles in the monkey's face. This animal's eyelids had closed down slightly, and they drooped, so that the iris had become a squinting oval. He put on leather gauntlet gloves, opened the door of the cage, reached inside, and pinned the monkey down. He slipped one hand out of a glove and quickly felt the monkey's stomach. Yes, the animal felt warm to the touch. It had a fever, and it had a runny nose. He let go of the monkey and shut the door. He didn't think that the animal was suffering from pneumonia or a cold. Perhaps the animal was affected by heat stress. It was very warm in this room. He advised Bill Volt to put some pressure on the landlord to get the heating system fixed. He found a second animal that also had droopy eyelids, with that certain squint in the eyes. This one also felt hot to the touch, feverish. So there were two sick monkeys in room F. Both monkeys died during the night. Bill Volt found them in the morning, hunched up in their cages, staring with glassy, half-open eyes. This greatly concerned Volt, and he decided to dissect the animals to try to see what had killed them. He carried the two deceased monkeys into an examination room down the hallway and shut the door after him, out of sight of the other monkeys. You can't cut up a dead monkey in front of other monkeys. It will cause a riot. He opened the monkeys with a scalpel and began his inspection. He didn't like what he saw and didn't understand it, so he called Dalgard on the telephone and said, I wonder if you could come over here and have a look at these monkeys. Dalgard drove over to the monkey house immediately. His hands, which were so confident and skillful at taking apart clocks, probed the monkeys. What he saw inside the animals puzzled him. They appeared to have died of heat stress, brought on, he suspected, by the problems with the heating system in the building. But their spleens were weirdly enlarged. Heat stress wouldn't blow up the spleen, would it? He noticed something else that gave him pause. Both animals had small amounts of blood in their intestines. What could do that? Later that same day, another large shipment of crab-eating monkeys arrived from Fairlight Farms. Bill Volt put the new monkeys in room H, two doors down the hall from room F. Dan Dalgard became very worried about the monkeys in room F. He wondered if there was some kind of infectious agent going around the room. The blood in the gut looked like the effects of a monkey virus called simian hemorrhagic fever, or SHF. This virus is deadly to monkeys, although it's harmless to people. It can't live in humans. Simian fever can spread rapidly through a monkey colony and will generally wipe it out. It was now Friday, November 10th. Dalgard planned to spend the weekend fixing his clocks in the family room of his house. But as he laid out his tools and the pieces of an antique clock that needed fixing, he couldn't stop thinking about the monkeys. He was worried about them. Finally, he told his wife that he had to go out on company business, and he put on his coat and drove over to the monkey house and parked in front of the building and went in through the front door. It was a glass door, and as he opened it, he felt the unnatural heat in the building wash over him, and he heard the familiar screeches of monkeys. He went into room F. Craw! Craw! The monkeys cried at him in alarm. There were three more dead monkeys. They were curled up in their cages, their eyes open, expressionless. This wasn't good. He carried the dead monkeys into the examination room and slit the animals open and looked inside. Soon afterward, Dalgard began to keep a diary. He kept it on a personal computer, and he would type in a few words each day. Working quickly and without much thought, he gave his diary a title, calling it Chronology of Events. It was now getting close to the middle of November, and as the sun went down in the afternoon and traffic jams built up on Leesburg Pike near his office, Dalgard worked on his diary. Tapping at the keys, he could recall in his mind's eye what he had seen inside the monkeys. The lesions by this time were showing a pattern of marked splenomegaly, swollen spleen. Strikingly dry on cut surface, enlarged kidneys, and sporadic occurrences of hemorrhage in a variety of organs. Clinically, the animals showed abrupt anorexia, loss of appetite, and lethargy. When an animal began showing signs of anorexia, its condition deteriorated rapidly. Rectal temperatures taken on monkeys being sacrificed were not elevated. Nasal discharge, epistaxis, bloody nose, or bloody stools were not evident. Many of the animals were in prime condition and had more body fat than is customary for animals arriving from the wild. There was nothing much wrong with the dead animals, nothing that he could put his finger on. They simply stopped eating and died. They died with their eyes open and with staring expressions on their faces. Whatever this disease was, the cause of death was not obvious. Was it a heart attack, a fever, what? The spleen was inexplicably weird. The spleen is a kind of bag that filters the blood, and it plays a role in the immune system. A normal spleen is a soft sack with a drippy red center, which reminded Dalgard of a jelly donut. When you cut into a normal spleen with a scalpel, it gives about as much resistance to the knife as a jelly donut, and it drips a lot of blood. But these spleens had swelled up and turned as hard as a rock. A normal monkey spleen would be about the size of a walnut. These spleens were the size of a tangerine and were leathery. They reminded him of a piece of salami, meaty, tough, dry. His scalpel practically bounced off them. He could actually tap the blade of the scalpel on the spleen and the blade wouldn't dig in very much. What he didn't realize, what he couldn't see because it was almost inconceivable, was that the entire spleen had become a solid clot of blood. He was tapping his scalpel on a blood clot the size of a tangerine. On Sunday, November 12th, Dalgard puttered around the house in the morning, fixing things, doing little errands. After lunch, he once again returned to the monkey house. There was a mystery developing in the Reston Primate Quarantine Unit. He found three more dead monkeys in room F. They were dying steadily, a handful every night. One of the dead animals had been given the name O-53. Dalgard carried the carcass of monkey O-53 into the examination room and opened it up and looked inside the body cavity. With a scalpel, he removed a piece of monkey O-53's spleen. It was huge, hard, and dry. He took a Q-tip and rubbed it in the monkey's throat, collecting a little bit of mucus, a throat wash. Then he swirled the Q-tip in a test tube full of distilled water and capped the tube. Anything alive in the mucus would be preserved temporarily. Into Level 3. 1989, November the 13th, Monday. By Monday morning, the day after he dissected monkey O-53, Dan Dalgard had decided to bring the problem with his monkeys to the attention of USAMRID at Fort Detrick. He'd heard that the place had experts who could identify monkey diseases, and he wanted to get a positive identification of the sickness. Fort Detrick was about an hour's drive northwest of Reston, on the other side of the Potomac River. Dalgard ended up talking by phone with a civilian virologist named Peter Yarling. Yarling had a reputation for knowing something about monkey viruses. They had never talked before. Dalgard said to Yarling, "I think we've got some SHF, simian hemorrhagic fever, in our monkeys. The spleen looks like a piece of salami when you slice it." Dalgard asked Yarling if he would look at some samples and give a diagnosis, and Yarling agreed to help. The problem attracted Peter Yarling's curiosity. Yarling had worked at the Institute for most of his career, after an early period in which he had lived in Central America and hunted for viruses in the rainforest. He had discovered several previously unknown strains. He had blonde hair, beginning to go gray, steel-rimmed glasses, a pleasant, mobile face, and a dry sense of humor. He was by nature a cautious, careful person. Peter Yarling spent large amounts of time in a Chemchurian biological spacesuit. He performed research on defenses against hot viruses, vaccines, drug treatments, and he did basic medical research on rainforest viruses. The killers and the unknowns were his specialty. He deliberately kept his mind off the effects of hot agents. He told himself, if you did think about it, you might decide to make a living another way. Yarling, his wife and their three children, lived in Thurmont, not far from Nancy and Jerry Jack's, in a brick ranch house with a white picket fence out front. The fence surrounded a treeless yard, and there was a large brown car parked in the garage. Although they lived near each other, the Yarlings did not socialize with the Jackses, since their children were of different ages, and since the families had different styles. Peter Yarling mowed his lawn regularly to keep the grass neat, so that his neighbors wouldn't think he was a slob. Externally, he lived a nearly featureless life among suburban neighbors, and very few of them knew that when he climbed into his mud-colored car, he was headed for work in a hot zone. Although the license plate on the car was a vanity plate that said L-A-S-S-A. Lassa is a level 4 virus from West Africa, and it was one of Peter Yarling's favorite life forms. He thought it was fascinating and beautiful in certain ways. He had held in his gloved hands virtually every hot agent known, except for Ebola and Marburg. When people asked him why he didn't work with them, he replied, "I don't particularly feel like dying." After his telephone conversation with Dan Dalgard, Peter Yarling was surprised and annoyed when, the next day, a few bits of frozen meat from Monkey O-53 arrived at the Institute, brought by courier. What annoyed him was the fact that the bits of meat were wrapped in aluminum foil, like pieces of leftover hot dog. The hot dog-like meat was monkey spleen, and the ice around it was tinged with red and had begun to melt and drip. The samples also included the tube containing the throat wash and some blood serum from the monkey. Yarling carried the samples into a Level 3 laboratory. Level 3 is kept under negative air pressure to prevent things from leaking out, but you don't need to wear a spacesuit there. People who work in Level 3 dress like surgeons in an operating room. Yarling wore a paper surgical mask, a surgical scrub suit, and rubber gloves. He peeled off the tin foil. A pathologist helped him do it, standing next to him. The bit of spleen rolled about on the tin foil as they poked it, a hard little pink piece of meat, just as Dalgard had described it. He thought, like the kind of mystery meat you get in a school lunchroom. Yarling turned to the other man and remarked, "Good thing this ain't Marburg." And they chuckled. Later that day, he called Dalgard on the telephone and said to him something like, "Let me tell you how to send a sample to us. People around here may be slightly paranoid, but they get a little upset when you send a sample and it drips on the carpet." One way to identify a virus is to make it grow inside living cells in a flask of water. You drop a sample of the virus into the flask, and the virus spreads through the cells. If the virus likes the cells, it will multiply. One or two viruses can become a billion viruses in a few days, a china of viruses in a bottle the size of one's thumb. A civilian technician named Joan Roderick cultured the unknown agent from Monkey O-53. She ground up a bit of the monkey's spleen with a mortar and pestle. That made sort of a bloody mush. She dropped the mush into flasks that contained living cells from the kidney of a monkey. She also took some of the throat mucus from Monkey O-53 and put it into a flask, and she took some of the monkey's blood serum and put it into another flask. Eventually, she had a whole rack of flasks. She put them into a warmer, an incubator, held at body temperature, and hoped that something would grow. Growing up a virus in culture is a lot like making beer. You follow the recipe, and you keep the brew nice and warm until something happens. Dan Dalgard didn't visit the monkey house the next day, but he telephoned Bill Volt, the manager, to find out how things were going. Volt reported that all the animals looked good. None of them had died during the night. The illness seemed to be fading away naturally. It looked like things were quieting down in Reston, and Dalgard felt relieved that his company had dodged a bullet. But what were those army people doing with the samples of monkey? He called Yarling and learned that it was too soon to know anything. It takes several days to grow up a virus. A day later, Bill Volt called Dalgard with bad news. 8 monkeys in Room F had stopped eating. 8 monkeys were getting ready to die. The thing had come back. Dalgard hurried over to the monkey house, where he found that the situation had deteriorated suddenly. There were many more animals with squinting, glazed, oval-shaped eyes. Whatever the thing was, it was steadily working its way through Room F. By now, fully half the animals in the room had died. It was going to kill the entire room if nothing was done to stop it. Dalgard became extremely anxious for some news from Peter Yarling. Thursday, November 16th, arrived, and with it came news that monkeys had begun to die in rooms down the hallway from Room F. Late in the morning, Dan Dalgard received a telephone call from Peter Yarling. A pathologist at the Institute had inspected the meat very carefully and had given it a tentative diagnosis of simian hemorrhagic fever. Harmless to humans, lethal to monkeys. Dalgard now knew that he had to move fast to contain the outbreak before the virus spread through the monkey house. Simian hemorrhagic fever is highly contagious in monkeys. That afternoon, he drove up Leesburg Pike to the office park in Reston. At 5 o'clock, on a gray, rainy evening on the edge of winter, as commuters streamed home from Washington, he and another Hazleton veterinarian injected all the monkeys in Room F with lethal doses of anesthetic. It was all over quickly. The monkeys died in minutes. Dalgard opened up 8 healthy-looking carcasses to see if he could find any signs of simian fever inside them. He was surprised to see that there didn't seem to be anything wrong with them. This greatly troubled him. Sacrificing the monkeys had been a difficult, disgusting, and disheartening task. He knew there was a disease in this room, and yet these monkeys were beautiful, healthy animals, and he had just killed them. The sickness had been entrenched in the building since early October, and it was now the middle of November. The Army had given him a tentative diagnosis, probably the best diagnosis he would ever get, and he'd been left with the unpleasant task of trying to salvage the lives of the remaining animals. He went home that evening feeling that he had had a very bad day. Later, he would write in his diary, "There was a notable absence of any hemorrhagic component. In general, the animals were unusually well-fleshed, butterballs, young, less than 5 years, and in prime condition." Before he left the monkey house, he and the other veterinarian placed the dead monkeys in clear plastic bags and carried some of them across the hall to a chest freezer. A freezer can be as hot as hell. When a place is biologically hot, no sensors, no alarms, no instruments can tell the story. All instruments are silent and register nothing. The monkeys' bodies were visible in the clear bags. They froze into contorted shapes, with their chest cavities spread wide and their intestines hanging out and dripping red icicles. Their hands were clenched into fists or open like claws, as if they were grasping at something. And their faces were expressionless masks, their eyes glazed with frost, staring at nothing. Exposure. November 17th, Friday. Thomas Geisbert was an intern at the Institute, a kind of trainee. He was 27 years old, a tall man with dark blue eyes and longish brown hair parted in the middle and hanging over his forehead. Geisbert was a skilled fisherman and a crack shot with a rifle, and he spent a lot of time in the woods. He wore blue jeans and cowboy boots and tended to ignore authority. He was a local boy who had grown up near Fort Detrick. His father was the chief building engineer at the Institute, the man who repaired and operated the hot zones. When Tom Geisbert was a boy, His father had taken him to visit the Institute, and Tom had stared through the heavy glass windows at people in spacesuits, thinking it would be cool to do that. Now he was doing it, and it made him happy. The Institute hired him to operate its electron microscope, which uses a beam of electrons to make images of small objects, such as viruses. It's an essential tool to have around a virus lab because you can use it to make a photograph of a tiny piece of meat and find viruses in the meat. For Gaisbert, identifying hot strains and classifying the tribes of viruses was like sorting butterflies or collecting flowers. He liked the loneliness of inner space, the sense of being forgotten by the world. He felt quiet and at peace with himself when he was padding around a hot zone carrying a rack of test tubes that held an unknown agent. He liked to go into the level 4 suites alone, rather than with a buddy, especially in the middle of the night. But his tendency to spend large amounts of time at his work had begun to affect his personal life, and his marriage was breaking up. He and his wife had separated in September. His troubles at home only reinforced his tendency to bury himself in level 4. One of Gaisbert's greatest happinesses in life, apart from his work, came from being in the outdoors, fishing for black bass and hunting for deer. He hunted for meat. He gave the venison to members of his family. And then, when he had got the meat he needed, he hunted for trophies. Every year around Thanksgiving, he went hunting in West Virginia, where he and some buddies rented a house for the opening of the deer season. His friends didn't know much about what he did for a living, and he made no effort to tell them about it. Gaisbert tried to look at many samples of virus as a way of sharpening his skills with an electron microscope. He was learning how to identify hot agents by eye, by looking at photographs of the particles. When the samples of the cardinal boy had arrived from Africa, Gaisbert spent days gazing at them. They attracted him. The cardinal strain was a tangled mass of sixes, U's, G's, Y's, snakes, and Cheerios mixed up with partly liquefied human flesh. Gaisbert spent so much time staring at the virus, one of the true horrors of nature, that the shapes became implanted in his mind. Tom Gaisbert had heard about the sick monkeys in Virginia, and he wanted to take photographs of the meat to see if he could identify any simian fever virus particles in it. On Friday morning, November 17th, the day after Dan Dalgard had killed all the animals in Room F, Gaisbert decided to take a look at the flasks of monkey cells that were ripening. He wanted to examine them with a light microscope before he went on his Thanksgiving hunt, to see if he could observe any changes. A light microscope is a standard microscope that uses lenses to focus light. At 9 o'clock on that Friday morning, he put on a surgical scrub suit and a paper mask and went into the level 3 lab where the flasks were being kept warm. There he met Joan Roderick, the technician who had started the Reston culture. She was staring through the binocular eyepieces of the microscope at a small flask. The flask contained cells that had been infected with the simian fever virus that came from monkey 053. She turned to Gaisbert. "There's something flaky going on in this flask," she said. The flask was a typical virus flask. It was about the size of a person's thumb and was made of clear plastic so that you could place it in a microscope and look into the flask. It had a black screw cap. Gaisbert stared through the eyepieces of the microscope. He saw a complicated world in the flask. As always in biology, the problem was to know what you were looking at. The patterns of nature are deep and complex, constantly changing. He saw cells all over the place. They were tiny bags, each containing a nucleus, which was a darker blob near the center. The cells looked a little bit like fried eggs, sunny side up. The egg yolk would be the cell's nucleus. Living cells ordinarily stick to the bottom of a flask to form a living carpet, Cells prefer to cling to something when they grow. This carpet had been eaten by moths. The cells had died and drifted away, leaving holes in the carpet. Geisbert checked all the flasks, and most of them looked the same way, like moth-eaten carpet. They looked real bad.